kaisernetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, we continue now. Please welcome our next panelists, Tefa Wanini Asafa, Executive Director of the Relief Society of Tigray. Satyan Mishra, Managing Director, the Drishti Foundation. Robert E. Rubin, Director of Chairman of the Executive Committee, Citigroup. And our moderator again is Dr. Judith Rodin, President of the Rockefeller Foundation.
Welcome, and welcome to all of you. This is the second half of today's Poverty Alleviation Working Group. In this panel, we're going to ask ourselves a fundamental question. That is, how can we make trade work for the world's poorest countries? Here's what we know. Developed countries around the world largely transformed their economies by expanding local, regional, and international trade. Among other factors, healthy economies depend on robust markets to lift people out of poverty. Trade offers the possibility of increasing producers' incomes, allowing them to build real assets. But the world's poorest have limited access to markets, as well as few of the skills necessary to succeed in a market economy. We spent some time talking about the skills and the capacity building. We're now going to focus on the markets and the more upstream developments needed as well. And while we're challenging ourselves with those big questions, here are several more to consider as we seek concrete, practical solutions. How can we harness the potential of rising global trade to benefit the world's poorest producers? How can we tilt the benefits of technology, of science, and engineering towards the 3 billion people living in extreme poverty? And most fundamentally, how and can we make globalization work for the benefit of the world's poor and vulnerable? We have a great panel to discuss these challenges, and again, we'll hear from our panelists first before turning to you for your conversation as well. So, Bob, if I may, I'm going to begin with you. We have some examples of success, but clearly the global trading system is complex. The world's poorest countries are neither competitive nor fully integrated into it. What are the trends we're facing with respect to global trade? How can we think about this?
Okay. Well, let me start just a little, directly respond to your question, but let me make a framework comment first. I believe very deeply in trade liberalization, and I think that it has been critically important to the well-being of the United States and the global economy. But I think actually, that is becoming a much more complex and uncertain situation than one that we're all accustomed to thinking about. Paul Samuelson, as you may know, wrote an article about 2 years ago in which he talked about the effects of the emergence of China and India on how one thinks about trade and the possible effects of trade on GDP in the developed countries. And I think that Professor Samuelson's argument was just the beginning, or just the early, or just one small piece of what actually is a very complex question, especially with disequilibrium exchange rates that we have today. And I think you're going to have a raging debate in the developed countries, Judith, and maybe most particularly the United States, about trade. And as the politics of trade have always been difficult, my instinct is to think they're going to be far more difficult going forward with all the difficulty that we've had in the past than they have been in the past. And I think all of that is going to be exacerbated by the effects of having what Ben Bernanke referred to at Jackson Hole in August as really an historic change in global competitive conditions, with the emergence of China, India, their vast scale, the absolute cost advantages they have at current exchange and wage rates, and the immense expansion, as Alan Blinder wrote in Foreign Affairs, the immense expansion of the range of tradable goods and services. So I think from the point of view of a developing country, a poor country, I think the threshold problem is going to be that the trade regimes in the developed countries, the United States is the one I'm most focused on saying this, but I have a feeling it's more broadly true from what I'm told, is likely to be worse rather than better, especially for trade with low-wage countries. One quick comment, if I may, on the emerging market or poor countries themselves, and that is that we can talk a great deal about aid, and we can talk about all the different components of having effective economies. But I at least believe, based on everything that I've experienced and talked to others about, that the absolute number one requisite that these countries have to have an environment that is conducive to investment, and that involves both movement toward market-based economics and, very, very importantly, effective government that is reasonably non-corrupt. And I think that if you look back over the last 50 years and you look at the great success stories in the emerging market or poor or developing country world, actually a lot, interestingly, with the exception of India, the reform occurred in non-democratic regimes, and that's another set of interesting issues, but leaving that aside for the moment, they all involved effective governments that pursued agendas built around education, infrastructure, trade liberalization, and much else. And when you see the countries that have failed, I think the number one problem is the ineffectiveness or, in too many cases, unfortunately, corruption of government.
Satyan, certainly India is viewed as one of these success stories, an emerging economy with tremendous growth opportunity. Your organization, though, still has so many challenges. You're focusing on making this economy work for poor people and integrating these people into the global environment, into the growth and opportunity chain. How are you doing that, and how do you see trade figuring into your efforts and your work, both trade policies and also trade opportunities?
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the Clinton Global Foundation and the CGI for inviting us here. We couldn't have got a better stage to talk about Drishti, the company which I represent here. What we have, first of all, just to maybe step back and tell you what we're trying to do. We are in the business of establishing an alternate supply chain. We have realized that the existing supply chain in villages is not efficient. There are multiple intermediaries. And for example, a family earning, say, $50 a month has to spend about $15 on accessing basic services and products. And I'm not talking about the cost of the product here. I'm just talking about the access. So far, we have been able to look at supplying products and services. We have about 1,000 kiosks, information centers in 1,000 medium-level villages. And we have services like government service, basic health care. We have a variety of products like battery, the cell phone, different things. Whatever the village needs, we are trying to supply that. But we have realized now that that is not the end. In fact, what we should be actively doing is to reverse the same supply chain by providing access to these marginalized farmers and artisans. And that is something which is going to be a real big challenge. Taking Drishti from 0 to 1,000 kiosks has been a very difficult exercise. But I can tell you that we have just touched the tip of the iceberg. There's much more to be done. And that can only happen, obviously, if there are more products and services which are riding on the network. There's a more compelling proposition for the community to come to the kiosk. But ultimately, once this gets established, then there is a possibility that the farmers, people who are presently, I think, bearing the brunt of the lack of access, they would be able to use this platform for doing a lot more. Just to maybe give you an example that the plight of farmers was not even maybe close to what it is today. It was, they were in a much healthier position about 200 years back. Things were much better for them. The role of women in the family was also very high. The status of women was higher than what it is today. What happened post-liberalization is that people started to move out of the village in search of better income jobs. And both land and women became assets. The land got fragmented because it was not a resource anymore. It was basically an asset. It got fragmented. And after the fragmentation, the productivity has obviously decreased because then there are the common resources are not utilized. the community as a whole initially was they had a lot of bandwidth to invest in the land, but that bandwidth is decreasing. The same thing has happened with the market. Something which was aggregated earlier has become highly defragmented. The mid-level farmers, the richer farmers have access to market. They can wait for the best price to be given by a local commodity market, while the marginalized farmers, they depend on intermediaries. They sell at almost half the price of what the richer farmer would be doing. So the problem is much more complex, and as I was, I think from day one, I realized that the two sessions today were had a lot of commonality, and the last session I had some discussions in which we actually thought of ways and means of aggregating the demand and aggregating the need of market access. If you do that, in some ways, marginalized farmers put together can be like a big farmer. So they'll have better resources to deploy at the field, and they'll have better access to market. So this is from where I'm coming. Obviously, there are global issues, there are global challenges, but going down at the micro level, I think these are some of the fundamental issues which are confronting us. And as we see extremism, as we see Naxalism growing in the villages, we are really, really concerned. Unless we provide market access to these marginalized farmers, I think more and more people will turn to hatred, they'll turn to ways and means which are not regarded as social in this world. Thank you.
Thank you. Tekle Luwani, you're working with maybe among the poorest producers on earth, people who truly are relying for subsistence living on what they can produce. Do you think, first of all, what are the challenges there, but also do you think about in this work also trying to, whether it's aggregate or think about providing access to markets, or is that just a kind of distant dream at this point because subsistence level is all that you're thinking about the ability to strive for?
If poor farmers are to be integrated into market, or if they are going to benefit the opportunity of trade, they have to be able to produce surplus. Most of the farmers, subsistence farmers, they only produce for their own consumption. They are not guided by market. So we should able to transform the mainstay of their economy or the agriculture. Unless otherwise, we transform the agriculture, unless otherwise we solve the structural problem of agriculture, these farmers are not able to produce surplus, are not able to integrate into the market, are not able to integrate into the industrial economy, then they are not going to benefit the opportunity of trade, the opportunity of globalization. So transformation is fundamental. And it is structural, and we have to solve it structurally. Then what are the prime movers for transformation? One is developing the human capital, education, health, skill. And we have also to change the attitude, the belief, the culture of the people. The second is we have to introduce different type of technologies. Now they are using traditional technologies, and which is not able to produce surplus. We have to introduce appropriate technologies. For example, in Tigray, where the poverty line is greater than 60%, we are trying to introduce drip irrigation so that they could be able to produce all through the year. Once, if they depend on rain, even in a good rain time, they only produce food for 3 months or for 5 months. So that is 100% for consumption, not for market. So we have to introduce appropriate technologies which could enable them to produce all year. We have to develop economic infrastructure. When we think of the Asian Green Revolution or the American agricultural development, it was based on irrigation. It is based on irrigation. in Ethiopia, in Africa, in Tigray, there is no any irrigation. It is 100%, nearly 100% rainfall. And with this, and the rain is very erratic. So with this, he cannot transform the poor farmers, and he cannot make them exploit the opportunity of trade. You have also to introduce different type of institutions. For example, microfinance. My organization is a pioneer in introducing microfinance in Ethiopia. Now we have got around 500,000 clients. Through this microfinance, they are able to produce surplus. They are able to produce more income. They are able to overcome their consumption. They are able to diversify and specialize. So we have also to offer side type of opportunities. They have also to organize so that they could have leverage in market. We have to have also enabling environment. There must be conducive policies. We have to fight against rent-seeking institutions and governments. So these are the prime movers. Then trade is a conduit of new ideas. Trade is a conduit of new technology. Trade is a conduit of competition. And trade also teaches the poor how to manage their resources. Trade also teaches them how to specialize and diversify and how to integrate into local, national, and international market. So if you are going to make poor farmers in Africa, in Ethiopia, in my area, we have to address the prime movers. We have to invest on this one. So here it needs a perspective, it needs a vision. So when a government or a private sector is going to invest, we have to have long-term perspective. We should not be engaged with short-term commercial benefits. So it needs patience. It needs long-term vision. It needs, we have to depend on the energy and innovation and creativity of the people. So as a result of it, we can integrate them. And still, transformation is picking up in Africa, in Ethiopia. And what we have to do is we have to cultivate it. And it needs huge investment from all sectors involved, say it nationally, internationally, and locally.
Well, a great catalog of all of the important elements. Let me try to dig down a little more deeply. Satyan, one of the mechanisms for the delivery of your services for information and tools are the rural kiosks that you have in so many local villages. Tell us actually how they work, why that is a good distribution point, and what you think you've learned from doing it that way.
I think when we talk about kiosks, we are basically talking about the last unit, the front end of a supply chain that we have built. Kiosks in isolation can be used for things like education, can be used for things which are offline. But the moment you talk about a supply chain, you need to have a very strong back end to support that kiosk. The power of internet, the power of technology is such that a farmer can, even without having the back-end support for procurement, which some of the other agencies in India are doing, has the information to select the right market for the product. So just to give you an example, that maybe when they normally carry their sack load of produce from the village, if they're not going through the intermediaries, that is, then they can know where to go, whether they go left or right, and that would depend upon the price which exists in two different markets. So that's just a very small example of the power of information which exists through the kiosk. Why we have taken up to kiosk as a means of solving a problem is because we feel that it's a very scalable concept. There are entrepreneurs in the villages who have the capacity to operate kiosk, and it's a purely entrepreneurial model. It's a for-profit model. a kiosk does service, saves money for the villagers, and in turn earns a small fraction of it. The villagers don't mind paying him for services which would have been otherwise free, but then they would have had to waste their daily wage, run after the service provider 10 times. If they get the same service at the doorstep, then they don't mind paying money. And just imagine that if somebody is paying 30% of the income to intermediaries, you can very well pay about 5% genuine fee to a rightful service provider and be happy with it. There are some examples of studies which have been done on the network which suggest that for every dollar one which the kiosk operator earns, there is at least $1.05 to $1.10 earning or saving for the villagers which happens. So this is why we are so committed towards this concept of a kiosk. Ideally, every village should have a kiosk. The moment you put a kiosk, you have put a strong bandwidth in place, and then you can think of doing whatever you feel like. Aggregation, access to market, capacity, knowledge, everything is there. It's just that it's the right channel, but still it is a very difficult exercise because for setting up a kiosk you require capital, you require connectivity, you require power, and all these are challenges today.
Teklawani, let me go back to you. You gave us in your last comments a terrific and lengthy catalog of all of the things that are necessary. You're working, though, in a particular way, in a particular area. I think you began during the terrible famines in the 80s in Ethiopia to solve that problem and to really address what the most fundamental mechanisms were to begin to both feed those relying on subsistence farming, but also then to build capacity. What are those fundamental elements? Where do you start?
First, we try to engage on active participation of the people. Without active participation of the people, we cannot address the severe poverty and famine. So as a result of it, we build the capacity of the people to plan, to implement, to monitor, to control. And this is our major asset. Besides that, we have also introduced different type of technology. For example, about more than 50% of the population are women. So if they are going to be engaged in productive activity, and if their opportunity is going to be enhanced, then we try also to overcome the bottlenecks. For example, we have fetching water, fetching wood is the role of women in our country. So as a result of it, we have developed a capacity with the help of different donors, even donors among some donors who are supporting us here, like Glimmer of Hope is also. We are now addressing the water problem and bringing water into the village. And as a result of that, women are now spending most of the time in productive. Second thing is, we have also introduced this microfinance. As a result of it, and it serves all the category of the population, women, youth, marginalized, we have already different type of productives. And based on that, we have already seen that their decision-making process has increased. They have developed self-confidence. They have tried to diversify and specialize their activities. And now they are now integrated into local and national markets. They have learned entrepreneurship and they have developed different type of skills. So, besides that, natural resource management, our area is highly degraded. And as a result of it, the agriculture is based on conservation. So as a result of it also, we have already introduced effective utilization of resource. And now they are using hillsides and growing trees for immediate use of energy and as a source of income. So we are introducing, it depends on the comparative advantage. You see, farmers are not homogeneous masses. They are heterogeneous. So you have to manage them like a business, one by one. So we are trying, we are also developing this capability. We also make research, and based on that, we try to communicate this the finding of the researches so that people can be aware of their potentiality and people can release their potentiality through the different processes. So these are some of the capabilities which we are trying to address, and we are having successful results.
That's great. No, it's a great model. Bob, you've developed policy, been there, done that, both at the national and at the global level. These are wonderful examples of things that happen on the ground, but I think nothing happens without the right policies, financial and trade-related policies. Many of us are nervous about the collapse of the last Doha round. I mean, how do you think these policies need to develop going forward, and then what's your prognosis for how they will actually develop? Either trade policies or financial policies
Could I address one other thing, though? Just listening to this, I was in Mozambique when I was, well, I was in Africa, when I was Sub-Saharan Africa, when I was at Treasury, but I was in Mozambique, and I was enormously impressed by the finance minister. I don't remember his name, unfortunately, but he was very, very impressive. And he told me about the agriculture in the hinterland, and he said there's really a lot of production going on, but we can't get it to the markets, and so we don't have an agricultural economy. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, we have rudimentary roads, but we don't have the trucks. So I said, well, that seems to me, I happen to be sort of commercial by nature. So I thought to myself, if I get out of this bloody treasury job, I could buy a bunch of trucks and I could really make some money here. But I knew I'd be out sooner or later, so I started thinking about that. So I said, well, that's interesting. Why don't we find people to buy trucks? As soon as I left Treasury, even before I went to Citigroup, I talked to some friends of mine who knew a lot about investing in Africa. And so I actually know some people who are pretty Europeans, not Americans, who are pretty heavily invested there. And it was interesting. It seemed to me that the problems in Africa are just enormous, but that the opportunities were also enormous. The problem is government in some measure, I think. And what these people told me, I was actually pretty energized around trying to figure out how to get involved entrepreneurially in sub-Saharan Africa. And they were quite discouraging in a way, because what they said was there is a tremendous opportunity there, a lot of good people to work with. There's great richness in Africa. There really are riches. And just listening to this discussion, it made me think of it. But the problem is you've got to get past the problem of government. And I don't know the answer to that, Judith. When I was at Treasury, Larry Summers and I spent a fair bit of time talking about how do you try to encourage better governance. And the trouble is you can say conditionality on aid, but it doesn't seem to have that much effect. And also it leaves behind the people who most desperately need your help, which are the people who have governments who don't care about their people. And it seems to me it's both inhumane and also in many practical ways counterproductive to not provide aid to people because governments over which they have no control are ineffective and corrupt. So I think it's a very complex set of questions. I still have this zeal, actually, but unfortunately, every time I speak to somebody about it, and I've continued to do that, including very recently a friend of mine in London who had very large agricultural holdings in sub-Saharan Africa, and he too was quite discouraging, maybe because he didn't want competition, I don't know, but I don't think so. I think he was being sincere. In terms of policies, Judith, my own, as you know, the equivalent of Fast Track, now called Trade Motion Authority, is going to expire in the United States next year. Sandy Berger would know better than I, but my guess is in today's political environment, that's going to be very hard to get renewed, like close to zero. In which case, it's going to be very hard for the United States to engage in multilateral trade negotiations, I would think, Sandy. Maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but that's kind of my instinct. So I think that a lot of these trade negotiations, a lot of trade arrangements are going to have to be regional or bilateral. And there's a lot of, I was told by the chief economist of Citigroup the other day, I was telling him about this, that there's studies that show the tremendous gains to be had for emerging market countries by working out all kinds of regional arrangements, as long as they're trade creating and not trade destroying. In other words, as long as they reduce barriers within the region as opposed to creating barriers outside of it. I think it's a terrible tragedy, or at least an economic, tremendous economic disadvantage for the United States not to be part of this, but I think the politics in our country are going to be terrible around trade, Judith.
And I think Africa in particular is trying to be creative about within continent trade policies and many new organizations and many new compacts, allowing them to think more creatively and more collaboratively, perhaps, about how all of that should work. Well, now it's your turn. For the next half hour, we'll have table conversations, and then we'll come back to our panelists. Thank you all very much, and please join me in thanking the panelists.
High idea people at these tables, and you'll probably talk about whatever you want to talk about. But let me just ask this. It's interesting when you talk about trade in the world today. At one level, you have what Tekleweni talked about, which is people who are just learning to be entrepreneurs. At the other end of the spectrum, we have people in our country who have a great deal of influence over how our trading system works. So our question on the table this afternoon is, how do we bring these two worlds together? How do we create new partnerships that can allow some of the expertise that have built phenomenal profits out of trade in the developed world to reach into some of these markets in the developing world? How do we find the patience to do that? How do we find the partnerships, and how do we find the mechanisms? Again, you will all want to take this, I'm sure, in your own directions. Let me encourage you to get forward. And again, Arturo and the team will be signaling you as to how much time we have left. And thanks again to the panelists.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Dr. Judith Rudin.
Thank you. And thank you all for the very good conversations and ideas. I was circulating a little bit hearing some of the dialogue, and I know that when Gail reports, we will have many, many good ideas to continue to learn from. We have a chance for another question or two to our panelists in the interim, and perhaps I can start again with Mr. Rubin and ask. There was, as we descended and walked to our table, a comment that it sounded very much like doom and gloom. And the question is that true? And what could we do to begin to turn the politics of trade around in the developed world? What will create the momentum to do that? I mean, aside from the obvious electoral things, but are there... I didn't mean it the way it sounded. I said the developed world.
I at least, Judith, am apolitical. I can't speak for you.
How do we do this?
Look, I actually thought I was rather upbeat relative to what I think the reality is, so I have a little trouble responding to that. Sandy Berger and Gene Sperling both know a lot more about the politics of trade than I do, and I don't think their views are dramatically different than mine. I think, at least in the, as Gene made a good point, though, at least in the immediate term, over the next few years, I think it's going to be very tough. If you could somehow or other put together what President Clinton always talked about, which was inextricably intertwining trade with a powerful domestic agenda to both promote productivity and also help those who are dislocated by trade, that's the right place to be from a point of view of policy and protectionism, which I think would be terribly dangerous for us. But having said that, I still have a feeling it's not really responsive to a lot of the political anxiety, a lot of the anxiety. Pew did a poll a month or two or three ago, I don't remember which, which said that 55% of the American people think their kids are going to be worse off than they are, 35% better, and 10% undecided. Well, that's a terrible change in the traditional view of America about the future. Now, Gene makes the point that if you looked out maybe 15 or 20 years from now, or whatever period of time that may be, when you've had wage rates hopefully converge, not by ours coming down, but theirs going up, and you have productivity going up in China and India, one thing or another, some of this problem may become far less serious. But I think it's immensely important for our country that we remain involved with trade liberalization and that we not move backwards. But I don't have a great answer on the politics of it. I think on the policy of it, I think we should do what I said a moment ago.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask either of the of our other two panelists, how do you develop the markets? You're taking local production, you're taking local activity, in a variety of product production, whether it's agriculture or other kinds of products. Bob made an interesting point about trucks. We actually noticed in one of our Rockefeller projects in Western Kenya and Uganda that the bananas were getting delivered across Kenya from Uganda to Mombasa in full trucks, and the trucks were coming back empty, and one of the interventions was simply to provide access on the empty trucks back into Uganda for the Kenyan farmers. So there's some very obvious, simple, straightforward, non-expensive things. Are there other ways that building markets aren't only the responsibility of the government and the government policies, but of the people on the ground who really are trying to manage their lives and livelihoods?
Development should be it should be owned by all the stakeholders. Otherwise, by government, I don't think so that we can have comprehensive or holistic development. But number one, policy-wise, business as usual scenario is over. We have to think differently. These traditional farmers, subsistence farmers, they have to be guided. Their production system has to be guided by market forces. We have to change the farming system. We have to change the rural economy. We have to shift them from staple food to high-yield crops. And these high-yield crops, they will generate high income, and it will be also an incentive for continuous production. So this is one thing. The second thing is that we have to make universal access of resource. For example, about this truck. Already in one village, farmers now are able to grow orange fruits. Then, by having that collateral, they are organized into cooperatives, and by having collateral, they are orange trees. They have borrowed from the microfinance, and they have bought mini truck, about 6 ton. Now they are distributing. So if we make, number one, if we make conducive environment, policies, and if you put institutions are vital for transformation, for development, and if you make these institutions also universal access to all the stakeholders, I think people in Africa, they are ready to reshape, they are ready to change, they are ready to adjust to new economic realities. The only thing is we have to give them the opportunity. We have to have proper policies, and we have to have shared vision and understanding of their situation, and we have to also make them actively participate in the whole process. If they do this, I think they can solve the problem themselves. We only help, we can be only catalysts or facilitators.
Sachin, sometimes the local farmer complains that he or she doesn't have information that would allow them to sell properly their products to the middleman, and that often they get taken. And so your kiosks, I think, provide an opportunity for a technological solution for providing market information on a 5-minute or whatever basis. There are those that are using cell phones, SMS, text messaging as ways to, as the first step of creating markets, of really giving the individual farmers or the collectives of farmers access to real market information in real time, so that they can move up the chain. Is that something that you're doing? Do you think that's a good idea?
I think giving out knowledge is, in a way, it reflects empowerment, and it's a very good tool. But that is not the only thing which the farmers require. And a very small incremental value would be added if only the market prices, the information about the market prices are made available to marginalized farmers. What they require is a solution. And the solution today is existing. It's just that the solution comes at a very high cost. So they require a platform to buy or sell. Information about the prevailing price is going to add a very small incremental value. At the same time, I don't have the perfect answer to the question which was posed by Judith, but I can tell you for sure that if an economy goes in the red, and that is the state of the village economies across the globe, then you can do two things. First of all, you can try and increase the income, which is the market access that we are discussing right now, or you also can decrease the cost. So agriculture somehow, I think, is being pushed up just a bit too much. With technology coming in, we should try and decrease the pressure on agriculture. There are many other avenues of livelihood generation which this new economy has thrown. And the villagers have to get engaged in other forms of livelihood generation. It is the moment the village becomes a more dynamic society and economically more dynamic, then there would be a local market which would be created. And that is a floor which is really required today. And if people are committing, if farmers are committing suicide, it is because there's no floor which is available. If things go wrong, they go drastically wrong. But if there is a market which is created inside the village, then they would know that, okay, they cannot go below a particular point, and which is the basic, a point which is necessary for survival. So, as I said, I don't have the right answer as of today, and we are working towards it. I'm sure that there is a lot of scope for generating access to market on a for-profit model also. At the same time, I think that we need to take some immediate step to generate other livelihood sources within the village so that a small market is created. And there is the amount of resource that we deploy in agriculture, there's a good return on investment from that. Right now, it's I think, highly disbalanced.
Thank you. Bob?
One quick comment, if it just occurred to me. There have been over the last 5 years or 10, well, something more than 5 years and less than 10 years, these vast new bodies of pools of capital around in private equity funds, hedge funds, and the like. I know a lot of these people. I talk to them a lot. I never hear ever, and risk premia across all asset classes have shrunk tremendously, so that the general view is that most asset classes are probably overpriced relative to risk reward. You never hear anybody talk about the kinds of things that we're talking about right here, Africa, the poor villages of India and so forth. If I were the Rockefeller Foundation, just as one example, and I really want to do something really good, what I might try to think of is, and there's a tremendous hunger to find places to put capital. There's just an enormous amount of capital looking for places to go. I would try to figure out some way to translate all of this into commercial application and then to tap these bodies of capital. Now, the problem is you've got to figure out how to do it in such a way that they're not afraid of the governments that they're going to encounter. But I think there's a tremendous opportunity there.
Yep, I agree with that. I do think there's a tremendous opportunity. You know, the word microfinance has become so trendy, and we're not thinking about other really alternative mechanisms for bringing capital, for bringing credit, to these communities that would be, I think, well-served and where there really is the capacity for entrepreneurship. Everywhere I've gone in Africa, I really am amazed at the entrepreneurial spirit of the African people. I haven't traveled as widely in India, but it's obvious from the growth of the economy. And so the kinds of capital tools, the things that work in stimulating markets where we have the confidence and we provide the access, seems to me a very creative area in which to be working. Gail, it's now your turn.
Thank you, Judith. And thank you again to all of our panelists. And it's interesting that you end on a note on financing, because I think that's something that all of you focused on a great deal. And we have six kind of themes, three that I think are quite concrete. The other three strike me as really principled approaches that we need to follow, and then some specific gems or nuggets.
One is that angel investors should be role models because entrepreneurs can work through challenges more quickly than governments. And I would remind you that we heard in our first session about what do you do where you don't even have governments, where you don't really have public policy. The second is the notion of using local cooperatives to develop domestic and regional markets for locally produced goods, and underscoring the important point that for the developing world, it's not just about exporting to U.S. markets. It's also about growing and sustaining local and regional markets. An MBA Peace Corps to work with business schools to exchange graduates with developing countries. I think that's a great idea. And I understand it came from a couple of places. We had the point raised in several sessions that producers in developing countries can use communication technology to leapfrog usual bottlenecks in the supply chain. And interestingly, our first session tomorrow is on technology and how we can grapple with that. Obviously, we've gotten back to the issue of trade agreements. We need to change the focus and place more emphasis on regional agreements, was the view of many of you. But also, and importantly, expand the network of actors and tap into religious leaders and leverage important diaspora expertise. Now, in the area of what we call gems, there are a couple things we wanted to tease out. This is not at all to suggest that there weren't many of these. But one is the concept of pull marketing, linking products manufactured in developing countries directly with specific markets in rich countries. And we've heard some examples of that earlier today, but I think a dedicated effort to do that rather than leaving it to chance. And also the notion of microinsurance, to improve access to risk assessment and insurance for small producers. In some of these countries, we're talking about a producer can be wiped out in less than a season if the rains fail. So how do we work on things like insurance that are relevant to some of the smallest producers in the world? And with that, I would like to turn back to Judith and our panel. We're going to ask our panelists to make their final remarks in light of these findings, and Judith to have the last word, after which we will release you and hope to see you all bright and early tomorrow morning. But Judith, back to you and the panel to summarize and close this up.
Thank you. Telkwani, why don't I start with you and what thoughts you have in seeing these recommendations?
I think most of the recommendations are quite valid and acceptable. But these recommendations, they have to be country-specific. At least they have to be very, very specific, because the reality, even as I said before, the traditional farmers are not homogeneous masses. So if you don't take realities or if you don't take context into the situation, we may not be able to maximize our efforts and potentialities. So I think this is one thing which I want to. A second is networking. It needs global networking. It needs strategic alliance. Poverty is borderless now. If you don't tackle it, it has got consequences in peace and security across the world. It has got consequences to the world development. It has got consequences to the social justice. So as a result of it, all of us, we should be the owner of that one. We should be the champion. We have to have passion to overcome it. Otherwise, if it is only the problem of Africa or the problem of a farmer living in Africa, I think that is, even before we were trying to solve it partially, now it needs comprehensive mobilization of resources across the world. So I think this is also the ownership by all stakeholders, because it is also our moral obligation to end poverty across the world. So this also should be included. Thank you.
Sachin.
I think these are excellent recommendations. I would like to fold them and post them to our government back home, especially the first one. At the same time, I think the idea about the MBA Peace Corps is also pretty fascinating. This is something which is very much in line with what we have been thinking, and if we can get some support all across the globe to figure out some business models which can be worked out in the field of agriculture, I think that would be very compelling. And as far as the gems are concerned, I think when we look at the micro insurance, first of all, the pull market is exactly the way to go. There has to be not just maybe a push which is which would be done by developing countries, but there should be a strong need for products in developed countries, and there should be one-to-one linkages which needs to be established. At the same time, the micro insurance somehow has to get initially, because the perception of insurance is very different in rural India. People are only very slowly getting across to micro insurance, and maybe I think that would be a phenomena across the globe. But the moment you link insurance to capital and finance, then I think people will make sense. And I think money lenders everywhere have already demonstrated that by charging a higher interest, they are somehow taking care of the insurance part, so they hedge their risk. So overall, I believe these are very precise recommendations, and we'll definitely like to take them back and work on them. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob?
I think in a way, Judith, I sort of made my concluding comment before, but I just to expand on that for 1 second. I do think some of these are very interesting. For example, where did this thing go? Oh, yeah. The MBA Peace Corps work with business schools. I would guess that if somebody actually took the trouble to do what you say, reduce it to specifics, become granular, I would guess there'd be a lot of receptivity in the business schools. But go to this pull marketing thing for the moment. I'm going to go back to my pools of capital. I think that if somebody would put in place the capability to map out actual projects, but it's going to have to be somebody with a lot of capability and that understands a local environment, and then developed attractive commercial proposals that you could bring to the kinds of pools of capital that I was talking about a moment ago. I think there's and if you can do it in such a way that people aren't going to be afraid of what they run into with government, which is a tremendous impediment, unfortunately, to this whole question, with respect to investment, private capital investment, I think there's a tremendous opportunity, but that's going to take a lot of serious work and very sort of specific mapping.
And I think even there we're seeing some preliminary work that is very effective. Some of the innovators in Silicon Valley who are setting up foundations and are asking those kinds of questions, how do you move some of those pools of capital over and seeking some significant opportunities, and we'll learn a lot from their examples. Well, we've heard today about the importance of civil society, the private sector, and government, each playing an extraordinarily important role individually and collaboratively, and sometimes those collaborations are difficult, they're problematic and fraught with concern, but they're worth the effort. We heard many very good examples today, and all of us know more. And that's what's going to be required at the fundamental level, pressure and support for government to do the right things, create pro-poor policies, and to sustain those policies with really deep attention, particularly in countries of growth. And here India in some ways may be the newest example where we see the difficulty still for the poor in an environment where many are benefiting enormously from the growth. We've heard a lot about empowerment and entrepreneurship. Really important concepts as you think about what kinds of sustainable changes at the individual level are going to be necessary in order for these things to happen. It's not only government, people have to change, and their aspirations have to change, and their ability to act on opportunities have to change. I mean, these are critical initiatives that really do enable both empowerment and the development of an entrepreneurial spirit and a reinforcement for entrepreneurial efforts. And we've heard a lot through these discussions about the search for and indeed the availability of many creative new mechanisms for financing and insurance were talked about, new ideas for trade partnerships are evolving, new ways of creating market demand, local ways of providing access to tools and communications networks, all of those are going to be absolutely essential. The critical thing that we need to continue to be focused on is globalization is providing extraordinary opportunities for so many people, but many people are falling further behind. And so we need to think about how to continue through the kinds of ideas that we've talked about to create the opportunities for everyone to be able to participate in the benefits of globalization. Thank you very much.